Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan in for Ann this morning. Longtime Jeopardy! Game show host Alex Trebek said in March that he had been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Within days, Trebek thanked the hundreds of thousands of people who sent emails, texts, tweets, and cards wishing him well. Some 2 months later, Trebek announced he was in near remission. The odds may still be stacked against him, but Trebek's experience has raised eyebrows about the tangible health benefits of well wishes. Deborah Umberson is a professor of sociology and director of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin. She studies the effects of social relationships and their role in health outcomes. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, thanks.
What did you make of the news about Alex Trebek being near remission? As far as announcing that his stage 4 pancreatic cancer was maybe in near remission?
Well, obviously, that's great news. And it was interesting to me that some of the news stories did connect it to the outpouring of support to him.
Yeah, I mean, it. In some ways, people say it might sound silly, but how much do you think that these wishes for good health and, just well wishes in general favored his recovery?
Well, I really don't know much about well wishes, but I can tell you about social connection and feeling supported and connected and cared for really does affect your health.
But you're not just saying, oh, send a text or a tweet. You want it to go deeper than that in order for it to really have a good effect.
Absolutely. I mean, the evidence that's out there is about feeling connected, but I can go beyond that because there is a fair bit of evidence that simply being around other people and even animals has a positive effect on health. That there are real measurable physical effects of just being near social others.
And when you're saying health, do you mean even before someone has some sort of disease or chronic illness?
Yeah, absolutely. People who are more socially connected live longer and they're healthier, both mentally and physically. But they're less likely to develop dementia and they're less likely to die. If you follow people, for example, over a 10-year period, the people who are most socially connected are about 2.5 times less likely to die than people who are less connected. And that's true if you're only looking at people in poor health or if you're only looking at people in good health.
Isolation really doesn't do us any good, does it?
No, I mean, I think isolation is the extreme and it's the worst. We're just social beings. Humans are social beings. And it really takes a toll on people if they're completely isolated. That's one reason that putting people into isolation and prison has such incredibly negative consequences for their mental and physical health.
I'm surprised you brought up the fact that a pet can really take the place of some human contact, but it really has shown benefits.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it takes the place of human contact, but it does. You touch an animal, there's love shared between an animal and the person they live with. So there are some ways in which it has those social connection benefits.
How much does it matter about who the person is who is making these connections to, say, someone who is suffering from a chronic illness or disease? What if it's a close friend or family member? Or what if it's only an acquaintance? Does that part matter?
You know, it does matter. People who have a close confidant, for example, people who are married, they're much more likely to have a confidant, and it's that kind of really close connection that has a multitude of benefits. I mean, you're more likely to engage in positive health behaviors, to have better psychological well-being, to have less cardiovascular reactivity. I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which having a close, caring relationship benefits your health. And it doesn't mean that less intense relationships don't also have benefits, but that kind of super close relationship is kind of the total package.
You know, I've noticed with some people who have chronic illness that no matter how much support they do have, in the end, they are fighting that themselves. It's a lonely battle because people aren't with them on a day-to-day basis. So how do you combat that, knowing that you want to help someone, but you can't be there 24/7. And so does simply a card or a phone call once in a while really help this person who in the end is doing this on their own?
I think any gesture of love and support is helpful. And there are all sorts of ways, maybe even unexpected ways, that those smaller things really matter. For example, sometimes when people are terminally ill or they've lost a loved one, and you talk to them about what's most helpful to them, sometimes it's not the people they're closest to that are most helpful. It's people who are going through the same thing they are, or somebody who just understands and is there to listen to them. So sometimes those less intense ties actually have more benefits depending on the circumstances. Also, you know, I always hesitate to talk about things like this because I feel like there's a lot of pressure on people to feel like, well, if only I could be more positive, if only I could be more socially connected, then maybe I would get better. And that's really not fair. I mean, the bottom line is all of us will eventually die, and there's nothing we can do, no matter how socially are connected to others, that we can avoid that ultimate reality. So it's not, I feel like it's kind of unfair to put it on people that you should go out and be more connected. You should be around people more, because that's not always the case. You know, as we develop serious illnesses and we decline, we have different kinds of needs. It doesn't mean we want less love and support necessarily, but we may need more time alone. And we certainly shouldn't feel pressured to go get connected so that we can get well, because that's not realistic.
But you mentioned attitude. Isn't it true that a positive attitude can have better effects on one's health as opposed to somebody who's suffering depression or is just a negative personality?
Well, you know, I think that that's very much tied up. It's tangled up with a lot of different things, so that if you're depressed, for example, and you're in bad circumstances, maybe you have a more negative attitude and negative personality, but it's your circumstances that got you there. So, and that's one way in which it gets tangled up with the health outcome. So it may be a lot of things going along together, for example, if you're ill, that contribute to that negative attitude. And again, you know, a lot of people who are terminally ill or who are, for example, maybe not terminally ill, but facing, dealing with a difficult cancer diagnosis and treatment, they often feel pressured to be more positive. Being more positive is not necessarily going to make their treatment work better. And I think there's kind of a public, popular perception that they can control it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't think it's a fair assessment.
What about when people say, you know, I'm offering prayers for you? How does that make people feel, first on the recipient end, but also those who are offering those prayers? Have you done any research in that regard?
Well, I haven't done research on prayers, but I think it's like any other kind of support. If you're the recipient of it, even if you're not a religious person, to know that people are praying for you and care about you, that's just another way of feeling loved and supported and connected, and that can be positive for your health. And in terms of being the provider of that support, I mean, there are two sides to it. If you if it makes you feel good and to contribute to supporting others and helping others, then that can be good for you. But a lot of caregivers, and there's a lot of research on this, feel very stressed and burdened and unable to express their own sadness because they're there to care for others. So a lot of times caregivers need support too.
And, true.
They, you know, there are ways to get that, but sometimes when you're a caregiver, you become more isolated. So that disrupts your own social connections, which can take a toll on your health.
You mentioned that in some ways people just want someone who can listen to them, especially if they can identify with what they're going through. I think this is where hospice is very important for many people.
Hospice is wonderful. And the people who work with hospice are especially good at feeling comfortable with silence, because sometimes people want to be listened to, but sometimes they just want someone there. And I mean, anybody can learn how to do that, but I think that hospice is very good at being comfortable and making people comfortable with just being, and, you know, being, getting solace from that, from being around others.
And in trying to get better, I mean, I know there are some people that just say, leave me alone. I don't really want contact with folks as much. Yeah, you can send me a card, but I want to concentrate on getting well, and visitors only make things harder.
Yes, well, there are people like that. I mean, and that is sort of a personality disposition. And it's really important to respect that. I mean, there's sort of a tension between respecting someone's desire for more isolation and solitude and not giving up on them,
right.
But remembering to continue to say, look, I'm here. Do you want me to drop by? Do you want to talk? Do you want to just sit together? It's good to keep offering and not stop. But some people, I think of them more like cats who like to go into a closet when they're sick. Some people are just like that, and they really do need that kind of solitude to help them recover.
Are we seeing healthcare professionals and those in the medical field realizing these benefits of compassion and care for their patients?
I think there is growing recognition, just like for, you know, a couple of decades ago, doctors didn't ask people about the stress in their lives. Now, you can hardly visit any kind of doctor without being asked about, are you, you know, experiencing any unusual levels of stress? I think the same thing is just starting to happen for social isolation and social connection, that medical professionals are beginning to realize there's a lot of scientific evidence that isolation is bad for you. And for certain populations, this is more of an issue for older people, for example, for caregivers. There are a lot of people who are more at risk for social isolation. And I think we're just at the beginning of health professionals really understanding and recognizing that. But I think we're getting there.
And what's their role in it?
You know, I think health professionals can't do everything. I mean, they're very busy, and especially in this era of managed care, they're asked to do more and more with less and less time and resources. So I think that one of the best things for them to be able to do is just know where those resources are so they can recognize when people need them and then provide them contacts with places where they can get the kind of support and connection they need.
Before I let you go, Deborah, if someone's listening and they know someone who has a chronic disease or is suffering and trying to overcome cancer or anything, what's your advice to them in order to help out that family member or friend?
Well, I think the first thing is to kind of understand what that person needs and wants, and to just feel comfortable with asking, you know, with saying, look, I heard this story and it made me think, I hope that you're feeling like you have plenty of support. Please know that I'm here for you, and that I'm willing to help you find any kind of resources that you need, and sort of figure out what the person needs and wants. The second thing you can do is just feel comfortable just being around someone and not quizzing them about what they need and want, and to recognize that people, when they're sick, sometimes they don't want to talk about being sick. They just want to have people around and feel normal.
Right, and talk about anything but their illness.
Exactly.
We are going to take one call here, Deborah. This is Cody in Cleveland. Cody, your comment or question, please.
Hi, sure. I'm a healthcare professional in the Cleveland area, and I just wanted to call and sort of provide some insight from a healthcare provider standpoint of sort of the different modalities, I guess, that you could say that we use when being on the other side of the patient bed. The hospital where I work, we use a lot of interdisciplinary services, whether that's through our interfaith network, which comes in and does sort of mindfulness training and that sort of thing throughout. I think that's a lot of times one thing that's really oversighted from a healthcare perspective is it can often be something that you see over and over again, but until you really put yourself in that active mindset of really identifying that you're dealing with individual cases, it makes it a little more intimate. Another thing that we use for patients who are terminal, end up passing, we use a really powerful intervention called the pause. And what it is, after the patient has passed, it's an opportunity for the team to gather around, remember the patient for the person that they were, the family that they supported, and then it also provides an initial basis of healing for the team because it does identify the nursing staff and the other healthcare providers for the efforts with that patient.
Interesting comments, Cody. Thank you so much. Deborah, your comments on that?
Well, first of all, it sounds like Cody's in a great healthcare setting that would be great for patients. and this idea of interdisciplinary teams, I think that's a great concept that some healthcare providers use. That sort of multifaceted approach to providing people what they need is wonderful. And I think giving support back to each other, for example, after a patient passes, as Cody described, is a wonderful strategy as well.
At Human to Human. Deborah, thank you. Deborah Umberson is a professor of sociology and director of the Population Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And we're going to take a break. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan in for Ann today. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved a drug last month that's being hailed as the new female Viagra. The move seems like a big win for women's sexual health, but the drug has some skeptical about its purpose and place in female sexuality. Dr. Julia Johnson is a reproductive specialist at the UMass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester, Massachusetts. Dr. Johnson, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the new drug we're talking about is called Valesi, we think.
Yes.
We're not quite sure the pronunciation quite yet.
I think that's the pronunciation.
We're going to go with it. But there's already a drug out there that has supposedly to help female sexual desire. So what's different about Valesi?
Yeah, it's given in a different way, and its mode of action is different. So they are not the same type of drug, but they're both intended to help with hypoactive sexual desire disorder, or HSDD. So they both are for the same purpose, but they work in different ways and they're administered in different ways.
How are they supposed to help women who have lost interest in sex or have no desire?
Now, the way that they are supposed to work is to improve interest. So specifically with the new one, what they did was they measured women's sexual function using an index, and they looked at a decrease in sexual distress, and that's what they measured compared to the placebo and found an improvement.
Was it a big improvement enough that they can say, yeah, this works?
It was significant. So it did show a difference. And so about a 25 to 35% improvement.
How is Valesi different from Viagra for men?
Well, Viagra for men deals with erectile dysfunction, and that's a very specific disorder for men where they have difficulty achieving erection. This is to really deal with the beginning of sexual function. You think of sexual function as having the desire, having the arousal, and then having, you know, the ability to complete a sexual activity. Well, this is the beginning. So having that desire, and so this is to have the interest in having a sexual interaction. And interestingly, that is less of an issue for men, although it does occur in men, less of an issue for men than it is for women.
Well, why is it difficult to create a drug to help women with sexual dysfunction or increased desire as opposed to men?
Well, it's a little bit simpler to deal with something as specific as achieving a orgasm. And interestingly, women do not have as much problem with that as men do. So they have less of an issue with that and more with an issue of desire. Desire is something that's very complex, and so many things factor into it that it's a hard thing to achieve success in improving.
With just a pill, probably.
Right, with just a pill, or in the case of the new one, it's an injection.
Who is the right person then to look for this as a possible answer for them? And you said injection, so can you also explain how a person would use it?
Yeah, the previous one, which is flibanserin or Addy, is a pill that you take every day. This one is an injection that you give yourself. It's subcutaneous, so it's a very small needle for those who are a little queasy about needles, and you take it 45 minutes or so before you want to have a sexual interaction, sexual activity. And the person to talk to about this would probably be your primary care provider, certainly, or your OBGYN.
And so who is the right person to take this drug?
It really is someone who is kind of talked with their doctor, their provider. And, you know, there's nothing else that's a clear reason for decreased desire. They're not having any discomfort. There's no significant relationship issues. They're otherwise healthy. No history of abuse. It's just that the desire is less than it used to be. And again, this is not uncommon. And so those women could consider it. Having said that, and I'll just put this right out there, there is good evidence that counseling, just talking about kind of working on a relationship and making some minor changes in a relationship, has shown to be successful. So it doesn't necessarily require medications to improve sexual desire.
There are many reasons why women can lose interest. What are some of those, Dr. Johnson?
Well, you know, a long-term relationship, again, that's not as much of an issue for men, but for women, if the relationship has become somewhat fatigued for them, that can be an issue. It's the same as it's always been. There can be just life stresses. I mean, women often are responsible for family issues. Many of them work as well. They may be fatigued or tired. They may have other issues with anxiety or depression. Those are the kind of things to look at. Are those the causes potentially of dealing with decreased desire in sexual activity? I've had women say to me, oh, really, one more thing I have to do today. And that's not the way you want to look at a sexual interaction. You want it to be something that is enjoyable and part of a positive relationship.
There are some side effects to this Vileci. What are they?
Yeah, the most common one is nausea. So people, about 40% of women who took it, did have, got queasy. Actual vomiting was much less common, but there was some issues with queasiness, and so that was the most common interaction or the most common problem, and it was the most common reason to not take it, to stop taking it. So obviously, if a woman decided to try this and it was sufficiently a problem with being nauseated, then that would be a reason not to take it. There is also an increase in headaches, not as much, but slight increase, and in a flushing sensation as well. So those are things to kind of watch for, and this has an effect on the brain, on what we presume is the hypothalamus, and so it's not surprising it might have some effects on those kind of symptoms.
We're talking with Dr. Julia Johnson. She's a reproductive specialist at the UMass Memorial Medical Center. And if you have questions about female desire, which we are discussing, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or send us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Johnson, do you have any idea of the percentage of population of women who have problems with desire, losing interest in desire, and maybe what age range it might be in?
Yeah, it is estimated that approximately 40% of women say they have sexual problems, but when you specifically look at sexual desire, it's estimated to be about 11% of women. So it's a fairly common, so 1 in 10, you could say, women have this as an issue.
And the age of those women, does it seem to run at a certain time of women's lives?
It does. It seems to be most common for women in their 40s and 50s. And I was saying earlier that certainly these are the times in life when we have many other demands. And so it's not surprising that it would be a time when sexual desire might decreased. But it is not an uncommon thing to occur as we are in our 40s and our 50s. One thing, by the way, to say about both of these medications that are now becoming available is that they are for women before menopause. They were not tested in women who are menopausal. The average age of menopause is 51, so just for women who are in menopause to know that that is not the group that was tested.
So now we have two drugs that are available for women who want to improve their sexual interest. Where do we go for research for drugs to improve female sexual desire? Is that in the forefront? Is there more coming?
Yeah, I don't know of any others that are coming at this point. These are the only two that are currently available. In the past, and this was quite a little while ago, there was some talk about having male hormone, testosterone available for women, but that was not approved. It is available in some other countries, but not in the United States. There was some real concern about its, health downsides, certainly that it has in men who use it, so there was concern about impact on women. But I'm not aware of any other medications. And as I said already, I tend to say to women that sometimes counseling without medications can be as or more effective than medications. Although, I must admit, I'm kind of the same way. It's simpler to try a medication than to do counseling. Even if it's only a couple visits to a skilled counselor, it's still more work.
But it is a bit more difficult to create a drug to help women with sexual dysfunction as opposed to men, because we are so different in the way we have sexual desire.
It is true. And in fact, between the two medications, they changed the Food and Drug Administration. At one point, I was on the FDA panel that looked at these medications. But in the past, they were looking at number of sexual activities. This time, they changed it to looking at the actual sexual function or dysfunction. So they're looking at it slightly different from not just the number of activities, but really the desire itself. So the FDA changed their way of looking at it from the original medication to this medication. And you could argue that one or the other are right, but I think that going forward, if there is another medication, they will look at actual desire measurements now that those have been validated and are available for further testing.
So you think there is enough interest in this from women, enough people who suffer from lack of sexual interest, that there will still be more work done to try to find a solution?
I think there may be. It'll be interesting to see if women have an interest in this new medication. Will really depend on how effective it is for them. It's a medication that actually was tested in an animal model and did show improvement, but of course that's mice, not humans. But it's an interesting way of really looking at a part of the brain that does deal with sexual function. So it'll be interesting to see how effective it is for women who do choose to use it.
And how long do you think it'll be before we see what happens in the general population? How long does it usually take for this to run its course where we start to get more definitive answers?
I say a year or two. They were disappointed, I know, with the flibanserin with the Addy that it did not take off the way they expected. Now, there were several reasons for that, but it never really got the number of users they had hoped it would. We will see what happens with this one, though. I think it really, to some degree, it's word of mouth, but it's also, if it's effective for women, they will probably continue to use it. The other issue, of course, will be cost.
I was just going to bring that up.
Yeah, they have not told us what the cost will be yet. And sadly, unlike treatments for erectile dysfunction, this is unlikely to be covered by insurance.
And why the difference?
Well, the argument has always been that hypoactive sexual desire disorder is not something that can be definitively diagnosed, and so it isn't truly a disorder, where it's very easy to diagnose erectile dysfunction. So that's the reason that insurance companies do not cover this. I do not expect that they will cover this. Sometimes the companies will let you try it for a reduced cost to begin with. We'll see what this company decides to do, but it will be interesting. I don't know how much they're going to charge, and that may depend, that may be a difference in how much it's used as well.
Right. We're talking about the new drug Valesi, already on the market to help women with female sexual desire. And we've been talking with Dr. Julia Johnson, a reproductive specialist at the UMass Memorial Medical Center. Dr. Johnson, thanks so much for your being here this morning and letting us know, understanding this a bit more.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Yeah, it's actually, I read just yesterday that they expect it to be available not until the end of the summer. I imagine they're getting ready for production of it. And again, I was checking for the cost and they still haven't said. So if women are interested in talking about this medication to their OBGYN or to their primary care, just let them know that it's not going to be available for several more months.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Johnson. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We're going to take a break, and listeners, you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org, and we're going to be right back. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, in for Ann this morning. A new study published in the journal Nature Communications found that some people born with six fingers are able to independently control their extra appendage. Researchers concluded that participants' brains adapted to the extra finger without affecting the other bodily functions. The results could have real implications for the future of prosthetics and the possibility of robotic limbs. Adil Akhtar is the CEO and founder of Psionic, a company developing prosthetics with highly sensitive touch capabilities. Welcome, Adil.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Can you explain or start by explaining our conversation what this six-fingered study we just mentioned is all about and why it's so important to people like you who make prosthetics?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the thing is that there haven't been a lot of studies on actual people that have extra digits or extra limbs. And so there's just been a question that's been going around for centuries, essentially, of how does your brain actually represent extra digits or supernumerary? That's what how we refer to it. Supernumerary digits that aren't typically part of the human body. And what this study shows is that your brain actually represents it as though it were just a normal extra finger that you can control just as easily as your other fingers. And even though your brain's size, its volume hasn't really changed, it just can rewire itself. It has that plasticity to be able to take care of controlling these extra digits. And so what that means for prosthetics is that given the right amount of sensory feedback and motor control to a user, that they would actually be able to incorporate that limb as part of their body rather than just being a tool.
Where does the landscape look like? What does it look like now for what you do, the prosthetic technology?
Yeah, and so currently, most of the prosthetics that are out on the market, they pretty much act basically like tools. So they'll read your muscle signals, and you can control them that way. But they all lack feedback and like sensory feedback. So if you try to touch something, if you lost your hand and you got like a state-of-the-art prosthetic hand that's on the market, and you tried to hold something, you wouldn't be able to feel from it at all. And because of that lack of touch and that lack of sense of where your fingers and joints are located, it's really no different than, for example, like controlling like a tool like a hammer, because you don't really you don't necessarily feel finely from the end of a hammer as you would with your own fingers. And so being able to give that touch feedback to users is very crucial in being able to move beyond just being a tool to actually having people incorporate that into their body and then having the limb be basically an extension of themselves.
And are we getting to that point?
I would say so. There's been a lot of research done by our group and many others across the U.S., especially with DARPA, looking at stimulating sensory feedback with prosthetic devices, and giving that sense of touch back to users has been like, it's just been an incredible feeling for the users. But also, it goes, like I said, the users are starting to feel as though their prosthetic limbs are a part of themselves.
You designed a robotic prosthetic arm that can do a little of this, am I right?
That's absolutely true.
And how do users control it, and is it different than other prosthetics?
So control-wise, it's the same. And so the way users control it, so let's say that you lost your hand right below your elbow. So all the muscles that control like flexion extension in your fingers are located in your forearm. And so by placing muscle sensors all around your forearm, we can then pick up on different movements that the user is intending to do, like if they're trying to make a pinch or a fist or rotate their wrist or flex their wrist or extend it. And then we have a machine learning algorithm that can detect all those different movements, and then the hand does the same thing. And so the flip side of that is that we've embedded pressure sensors, so highly sensitive pressure sensors in the fingertips that they can detect super light touches all the way to very strong touches. So, for example, we've had people in our lab grasp hollow eggshells without cracking it while blindfolded on their first try, because they can feel exactly how much pressure they're placing on the eggshell without, and because they don't crack it, it's because they have that feedback that they never had before with their other prosthetic devices.
Wow, that sounds amazing. I mean, how does this prosthetic sense of touch reach the brain? How do you get that interaction? Because that's where you need to get it from.
Yeah, and so we do it in a couple of ways. So one way is we just vibrate the skin with a vibration motor. So that's the same thing that's like in your cell phones. But a lot of our research has also been on electrically stimulating the skin as well. And by changing the amount of current we send across the skin, the timing of it, the frequency of it, we can actually make it feel like different things like light touch, strong touch, vibration, sometimes even pressure. And so now we're working on making that feeling consistent over longer periods of time.
Where are you in the development of this, Adil?
So we're actually releasing our first limb this September, and it should be covered by Medicare and other insurances as well. So we want our patients to have the best available device at the most accessible price.
And which prosthetic is going to be made available? What can it do? What will it do?
Yeah, so all five fingers will be able to flex and extend, and the thumb will be able to rotate as well. It is able to hook into wrist rotators and elbows as well, made by other companies. And the best part is that they'll actually be able to feel from it. So that's going to be a game changer in the field.
Is this real feeling for these folks or phantom feeling? Like some folks who have lost limbs say that they feel like they sometimes can feel the limb even though it's not there.
Yeah, so with the vibration motor, it's going to be a little bit more of that phantom feeling that you're talking about. When we move to stimulation in the future, that's actually tapping into the nerves that they still have intact, and being able to recreate that feeling that they originally had from their prosthetic limb, or from their actual limb, their intact limb.
We have come a long way in prosthetic technology. What has changed besides what you've just described in the past two decades?
Yeah, so I mean, really, it's just been the hardware available and the processing power available in small form factors has just been exponentially increasing over the last couple decades. And so, you know, 10 years ago, you wouldn't be able to do any of this stuff that you'd be able to do now. And especially with things like, for example, 3D printing, that's just made prototyping these types of devices so much quicker than ever before.
Oh, I never thought about that. And now, are we talking about prosthetics for legs, arms, everything is moving in that same direction?
Yes, absolutely.
You had a defining moment as a child that impacted you and led to your interest in prosthetic limbs. What happened?
Yeah, so this whole thing for me started when I was 7 years old. I was visiting Pakistan for one of the first times I could remember. That's where my parents are from. And that's actually the first time I met someone with an amputation. And she was my age, missing her right leg and using a tree branch as a crutch, living in poverty. And that's basically what inspired me to want to go into this field and make the most advanced bionic limbs that are accessible to everyone worldwide.
What about your company? Can you tell me a little bit more about that? And I don't think you're very old either, are you?
I'm 31.
That's pretty young to start a company. Come on.
So my company's name is Psionic, and our whole mission is to develop advanced bionic limbs that are accessible to everyone. And for us, the company really started taking flight when we got the chance to go to Ecuador about 4 years ago and to work with a nonprofit organization called the Range of Motion Project. And their whole mission is to provide a more equitable distribution of prosthetics to those worldwide. And so we worked with a man. He lost his left hand due to machine gun fire from a helicopter 35 years ago. He was in the Ecuadorian army, and there was a border war between Ecuador and Peru. And you have to imagine that the hand that we brought down was like three times the size of a normal human hand. It had wires going everywhere, plugged into the wall, plugged into power supplies. And then despite that, our patient felt as though a part of him had come back, because he was able to make a pinch with his left hand for the first time in 35 years. In fact, he had forgotten how to make a pinch with his left hand, and we actually had to retrain his brain in order to remember how to do it. And so when he said that a part of him had come back, it wasn't just a moving moment for him, but for us. And we realized at that point that we want everyone to feel the exact same way that he did, and the only way to do that is to start a company and commercialize the technology that we've been developing at the University of Illinois.
What are some of your biggest challenges then going forward when designing these prosthetics?
Yeah, so a lot of it's just, there's like always technical hurdles. So our hand is going to be waterproof, and so we're just putting the finishing touches on making it waterproof right now. And so just like the little things that you need to account for. And just making sure that, like, stress testing it with patients and, like, having them use it for, you know, weeks to months and making sure that everything's okay. So that's what the immediate future is looking like for us.
Is this going to be adult use only, or then as you go along you'll make it for children or, you know what I mean, different sizes?
Yeah, absolutely. And so for us right now, we're about teenager size and above. And we're actually working on a child-sized version of the hand as well that should be coming out within a year afterwards.
Knowing that the brain can adapt to limbs, and as you just mentioned, how you had to retrain the brain then to use that hand, which is fascinating, are we heading toward a time where prosthetics will be able to connect to the nervous system directly?
Absolutely, and that was a huge part of the DARPA project that I was mentioning a little bit earlier. And so the field is definitely heading towards implanted electrodes. So basically medical like sensors and actuators that connect directly to your nerves. And by doing that, it gives you a lot finer control. So for example, right now, you might be able to do a handful of grasps very easily. So like a pinch or like a fist or control your wrist. But you aren't really able to do individual finger control very robustly outside of the lab. And so by tapping into the nervous system directly, you're able to get that very fine control. And also on the sensory feedback side, you're able to get very specific locations, like tapping into the fingertip, for example, and then make a pressure sensation coming from the fingertip. And the good thing is that the hand that we're developing is already ready for those systems. So we're starting to collaborate with a lot of these DARPA researchers as well who are doing invasive studies.
And where would these be implanted? Is it in this? Because I'm a little confused on that. Is it in the skin, like the upper arm where there is still feeling, or is it in actually the prosthetic device itself?
So the implant would be in the residual limb of the user, so where their nerves are still intact.
Okay.
Underneath their muscles. And then the hand would communicate to those sensors wirelessly through like Bluetooth, for example.
Where do you see your company going from here?
We definitely are looking into a lot of the technology that we've developed for the hands are directly applicable to knees and ankles as well. And also exoskeletons. So definitely we're looking into those directions in the future as well.
And how long does it take to develop something like this, Adil?
So we've been working on our hand. We've gone through about 8 prototypes in the last 4 years or so, and we've got a pretty lean team. A lot of us started out as students at the University of Illinois, and then we spun it out into a company, and we're still located in their incubator, their startup incubator over there. And the thing is, like, you know, once we get to those milestones of getting our first product out the door, then this whole process will become a lot easier for us as we come out with new products in the future.
I think people would be amazed if they knew the number of people just in this country alone who really need prosthetics.
Yeah, in this country alone, I mean, there's over like, let's see, maybe probably close to like 800,000 amputees in the U.S., and that includes both upper and lower limbs. And the numbers are just growing. Diabetes is one of the leading causes of lower limb amputations. Trauma is the leading cause for upper limb amputations, so war and motorcycle accidents. And then with population growth, you just have a larger number of congenital amputations as well.
I don't think people are probably aware of how many there are and sadly how that need is growing.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, worldwide, it's even crazier. Just for hands alone, there's like 10 million people with hand amputations worldwide, and 80% of them are in developing nations. And that's why it was so important for us to be able to make our advanced hands at a price point that will be affordable worldwide as well.
And so you really do have this idea of making this something that you are able to spread to the entire globe.
Absolutely.
Well, Adil, congratulations to you and what you are doing. Adil Ektar is the CEO and founder of Psionic. It's a company developing prosthetics with highly sensitive touch capabilities. And I think you're just beginning to develop some really good things.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adil. That's all for today, and thank you for listening. I'm your host, Gail Hogan. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.